My name's Heiko Ku. I'm a candidate for the Workers' Party in Putney. I've been speaking at Speaker's Corner since 1985, the end of 85, and I'm involved in politics on the left from a socialist standpoint, but I'm opposed to a lot of the restrictions on our freedoms and rights that have been done in the name of Big Pharma, in the name of climate and other things. And therefore, I think I kind of got a bit of a unique position for those of us on the left. And so I think it's worthwhile putting that position to the public during the election. What was the second part?
The timing of the election is very surprising since the Conservatives are so low in the poll.
Yeah, one of the interesting things was that the main speech that was made by Rishi Sunak in advance of the election was not that damp squib of a speech when he was soaked in the rain, but it was the speech he made after the election victory in Rochdale by George Galloway. And it was to charge onto, and it was quite a coherent speech. And there he declared that society has been riven apart effectively by hate conflict associated with the conflict in Gaza, and warned of the rise of extremism, which Galloway's election supposedly represented. And I think there might be a component in the calculations of the Conservative Party to try to, if you like, maintain the status quo by propping up the Labour Party. Effectively, there are people, I think, behind the scenes who know very well that there is not much difference of any significance between the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, and want the Labour Party to take over as a new face for the same interests that control society, be it the Zionist lobby supporting Israel, or be it big corporations, pharma, big tech, and the rest of them. Because Keir Starmer is actually not offering anything of any difference, and the different policies that are being proposed are relatively insignificant for the fate of society, although they make a number of buzzword proposals, which they would never, almost certainly never introduce regardless. For example, the idea of a national service and so on, the likelihood of that happening is pretty much zero. And therefore, it's simply to pretend that there is some substance to the differences between the Tories and Labour.
We've had this week a rowback by Labour on the policy of child support, which I found quite surprising. They're saying that only the first two kids, just as the Conservative policy now, Rachel Reeves and Angela Rayner are saying yesterday, that only the first two kids will get child benefits. So you do wonder, where are they getting these policies from? They actually seem to be coming more in line with Conservative policies as they get more confident that they're going to win this general election, Labour.
Yeah, and of course, the policies that they, even the policies that they accept or they claim they're going to introduce, they will not introduce, or they're not likely to introduce. And this is the pattern of Keir Starmer. That's what he's saying. He's saying, I stood in the election as leader for the leader of the Labour Party, and I put down whatever was necessary to get elected. And then I did the opposite. And he's saying exactly the same now. Basically, there are five steps to heaven, which he is proposing. I'm not sure that any of them are memorable. I think that's the intention, that you shouldn't remember what they are. And then he makes minor appeals to or tries to get some focus group to advise him on how to capture sections of the Conservative vote. And the VAT question is one of those.
So, I mean, we're nowadays, I mean, if you were to go back, say, you know, even 50 or 100 years, you'd see much more campaigning out in the constituencies where people would actually meet politicians, see them, actually heckle them. Now we've got a very kind of stage-managed, manicured approach where actually the politicians themselves even select the journalists to ask the questions. So they know them by name. They call them, the politicians call the journalists by their Christian names.
Yeah.
And they just, there isn't really any room for the public or even independent press to get into these conferences or to ask questions of the politicians. So the whole thing is kind of managed by mass media. I know you have taken some initiative with some colleagues of yours in London to try to get this election back to the public. What are you up to and how are you doing that?
Yeah, back in the day, I mean, you know, I speak at Speaker's Corner. Back in the day, people would do soapbox speaking in their community. And the last time that really was at least emphasized was when John Major defeated the razzmatazz of Neil Kinnock by going onto the street in Brixton on a soapbox and being heckled by a load of lefties. And the point he made there, which was a surprise in the election, was that if you go to the street and you talk to the street, even if you're heckled and argued with, it's more in the original tradition of what democracy is supposed to be about. Because you're calling an election, and it's not about is Starmer or Sunak in power. It's about hundreds of members of parliament who are supposed to be representing their constituents and supposed to be standing up for something themselves, not just machines following a line determined centrally, which is really no different from what they accused the Soviet Union or China of doing. And so when I try to arrange meetings for, I was given a list of meeting rooms by the officer of the council, which we are able to get for free. At least we shouldn't be paying the costs of hiring the room. So we have to pay for lighting and heating and stuff like that. But otherwise for hiring the room, we don't pay a cost. And so when I attempted to hire rooms, I found there were enormous obstacles in the way, starting with the fact that the renting of rooms in schools and a lot of other institutions that are funded by the government and that are supposed to be available under the Representation of the People's Act 1983, that it has been farmed out to private companies, some relatively small companies, but whatever reason they've been given, because of lack of resources or lack of initiative or whatever reason, the renting of rooms has been largely, or at least around half of the places, farm this out to private companies. And so I got to get faced with this problem. I made sure because the stipulations are that the room must be available for rent and not already be booked. So in other words, I had to book the rooms under the auspices to identify what dates they are free and to make sure that I can get that room. And then I have to go and say after the event, actually, we shouldn't be paying for this, or better said, you're not allowed to charge us for this. So I've just had that with the library just now, for example, in the public library. We booked a number of meetings at the public library and they were accepted. They sent me a bill a few minutes ago for £950. And I then wrote to the council officer, who then wrote to the library this morning. So he's been very efficient on this. But he did say to me, no one else has ever done this. No one's actually, I mean, in his memory, of course, going back to the 1950s, 60s, 70s, it was the norm for politicians to put themselves in front of the public and for the public to attend meetings, which would have been in local meeting halls or schools, which would have, as part of the course, offered these buildings for these hustings events. And there, you know, heckling and argument and debate from the floor would have taken place. The couple of hustings that we have done have been, so far, have been characterized by the selection. Perhaps the most important point was the selection of questions in advance sent in online. Now, I don't agree with that. I think if you're going to have an election debate, the election debate should focus around the people in the room. And this was noticeable last night. That was that in the St. Mary's Church debate, no insult to the person organizing it, but it was entirely based on questions that had been sent in online and selected by the chairperson to be the questions that were discussed. Now, I'm not saying they were terrible questions per se, but it really doesn't give the cut and thrust of debate a chance to develop. And that's why I support the initiative launched by Eilish Jordan, who got together with myself and three other people and decided to create something called the PutneyDebates.uk is the website. And the Putney debates are a sort of revival of the historic debates that took place in 1647, when Cromwell's army decided to debate the future of Britain and the future of democracy. And the question was, do the people have the right to vote, and how should power be exercised? And what's the relationship between property and rights? And So these series of debates that we've organized are with the intent of going into greater depth and providing the people in Putney with perhaps the most comprehensive series of debates during the course of this election. And I think that it could set a standard for how debates should be run in future during elections, because it simply isn't enough for parliamentarians to be elected and then attend this or that meeting or this or that cause, and then the rest of the time do nothing and get their votes based upon television presidential discussions about Sunak and Starmer or whoever the leader is. I think politics needs to go back to the grassroots. And in fact, all the local issues that come up involve some kind of grassroots requests for action. And basically, they would require meetings such as we're holding. So that's the idea, is to rejuvenate democracy during the electoral process in order for people really to have a chance to cross-question the candidates and find out what their fundamental ideas are, whether you agree with them or not.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things here. Firstly, an online debate, if you're sending in questions in online, even if it is in person, you come along to afterwards, which Bristol City Council also does these now, where you've got to submit questions online beforehand, precludes anybody that is not online, and there are particularly elderly and wise, our elders citizens that just simply don't do this kind of thing. So they're excluded, as well as any developments that are happening actually during the discussion and debate, they're excluded. And also anything that's been in the news for a few days before the discussion and debate, that's also excluded. So this is really a denuded discussion. It's not a genuine discussion at all. What do you make of, then there's also the fact that in these TV debates that we've been having on national television, I noticed that there are only the seven top, they call them top anyway, well, we don't know actually what the top are, but the seven top parties are invited. That's Labour and Conservative, SNP, Plaid Cymru, Green, not sure what they all are. Oh yeah, Reform, that's right.
Yeah.
But George Galloway's party is standing in many, many constituencies across the country, the Workers' Party, and yet they are number eight, and they've been excluded from almost all the ones I've seen anyway of these national debates.
Yes, I had to write to the Evening Standard a few minutes ago, because there they have an article published, like who the election in Putney, who can I vote for? And then they've got the Tory Party candidate, the Labour Party candidate, and then a list of five candidates says these are the main parties standing. And this is not a newspaper article. This is an online article where they deliberately avoided putting my name down and putting the name of the person standing for Rejoin EU. So how can a newspaper be allowed to present the public, and it's an influential newspaper with a wide readership, even online, be allowed to present the case that there are only five parties standing? Or even though they worded it, and that's why I think it is malicious, because the wording is very specific and it says the main party standing, as if adding two names underneath and two parties underneath would somehow be too much of a strain for the space on their website.
Yeah, why do you think it is that Galloway is seen as a threat then? Because there seems to be deliberate exclusion of George Galloway's Workers' Party from the particularly the mainstream media coverage.
I think they're really scared. I think they're scared that if Galloway's party or the Workers' Party is able to freely express its point of view, and in many constituencies, there's a very strong feeling about the issues which George Galloway and the Workers' Party have taken up, particularly over Gaza, then there can be upsets that they don't expect. And the ball can get rolling in terms of challenging the so-called authority of the Labour Party over Labour voters. Anyone who's followed what happened over the last few years knows fully well that Jeremy Corbyn was removed, at least partly, but not only partly, but under a significant amount of influence of the Israel lobby, who were determined to remove him by hook or by crook, using slanders and lies about anti-Semitism. And once they got rid of him and smeared everyone else who they wanted to, then, of course, the anti-Semitism story just quietly disappeared from the Labour Party, except where if you're, you know, perhaps a Jewish activist who supports Palestine, then you might still be, you know, thrown out of the party at the will of the central office. And so the party has been turned into an instrument of power on behalf of big business and of the Israel lobby. And the actual members have been disenfranchised. And so there is a widespread knowledge of this. People know very well that the party has been, its power inside the party has been usurped. And therefore they're doing everything possible. The combined establishment, the same ones who launched the smear campaigns against Jeremy Corbyn, you know, the Laura Koonsbergs and the entire mainstream media apparatus are in a conspiracy collectively, to not mention the Workers' Party, you know, just like don't mention the war in John Cleese, you know, in the 40 Towers. And that's what we've got. We've got a kind of 40 Towers world, you know.
Yeah. Well, look, the Workers' Party is thought of largely as a pro-Palestinian party. But what about domestic policies? Do you have those? Just to ask you about the platform you're standing on.
Yeah, the Workers' Party manifesto argues that the imperialist wars that we're fighting are the consequence of a long background of the history of British imperialism, and Britain needs to purge itself of that imperial background and to call a referendum on NATO membership to end the war, the support for the war in Ukraine, and to isolate Israel. And the other thing the Workers' Party stands for is to redistribute wealth to the working classes. That means taking public ownership of whatever industries are necessary. In my opinion, the commanding heights of the economy should be in public ownership, but we can begin with water, electricity, the railways, gas, and move on to those other sections of the economy that need to be taken into public ownership, and empower the working class to administer and manage companies by creating workers' councils of some form or another to allow the workers to participate and to shift private companies as well from under control of shareholders to being under the control of missions determined by the workers and determined by the communities themselves. So what we're basically to, and also the key questions are, for example, about digital life. You know, cash is being undermined and digital life is taken over. We need to step back from that and move back towards a cash-based community life, and also to oppose the cultural wars that have been fought out, which are detrimental to our communities and our social life. And those are the central elements, I think, that I'm standing on.
Now, I mean, we're looking today at a largely divided Europe, particularly between Russia and the rest of Europe. And you talking there about leaving NATO. There are all sorts of warnings going out about the provocations of the NATO countries using Ukraine as a proxy, actually hitting some important strategic Russian sites, such as bases, air bases where their nuclear bombers are based, early warning radars. And command centers actually in Russia itself. Now, Russia is increasingly seeing this as a NATO attack rather than just a Ukraine. In fact, many of these bases are not even relevant to the Ukraine war that supposedly Ukraine's hitting. So what do you make of the way that this is developing? I mean, there's some in Russia are saying, well, we should hit a few European countries with a nuke. That will soon shut them up.
Yeah, the British seem determined to be belligerent advocates of Ukrainians firing British weapons or American weapons or German or French weapons into Russia. And this is an act of desperation, illustrating that Russia has effectively won the war, bar the peace deal. But they're scuppering any possibility of a peace deal. And that's why they held this absurd event in Switzerland a couple of days ago. Ukraine will lose this war, and they will lose territory, the territory basically in the Donbass, and the Crimea will have to be accepted that it is part of Russia. This is a simple fact, and everybody knows this. Zelensky knows this. The West knows this, but of course they can't admit that they failed. And so more and more Ukrainians and Russian men will die in the trenches. And this is what we've got, a trench warfare. We need to get out of this war. We need to make peace with Russia, peace with China, and bring our societies closer together, exchange goods, exchange resources. And that will raise the living standards of the people, rebuild the pipelines that were blown up, and facilitate an international cooperation and exchange between the countries of the world economically and between the people of the world, particularly the working classes of the world, socially and culturally.
And what have you got to say to anybody who's thinking maybe about voting for the Workers' Party, but understanding that in the first past the post system, there's really no point?
Well, you can argue that about any political party. I mean, in fact, where there are big majorities, for example, the first past the post system might well lead people to say, I am going to vote for something different. And there is no foregone conclusion about which party wins. Sometimes people make up their mind on the day. I think people are volatile in their political direction. If they're voting determined by what's on television, well, then they probably shouldn't, to be honest with you, they're not making an informed decision. They should get involved in the local hustings debates. That's why we've also organized so many of them. We've posted them also online so that people can watch the video debates. And I don't think that's happened anywhere really around the country. There might be one or two, but we've already posted two full videos of the events of the hustings, and we will be posting many more so that people can actually make their decision. Based, even if they weren't at the meeting, they can observe the discussions that took place. They're in-depth and detailed and covering many subject matters, and they will get more in-depth as we go along. And in that way, they can make up their minds based on a properly informed, you know, there is a lot of discussion over the last years about informed consent in medicine. Well, informed consent in medicine can also apply to informed consent in politics. Are you actually informed about what the policies are, the programs are, the philosophies behind them? Are you informed about that? And once you're informed about that, you can make a decision as to vote for one party or another. But without that background information, it's, you know, it's the manipulation of people in the typical propagandist style of the advertising elites and the large corporations.
Yeah, it almost does seem as if this is a private sector election. I hate to say it. You're up against people like the Reform. Now, they've had an enormous surge, at least in opinion polls. What do you put that down to? And do you think Workers' Party, maybe later in this campaign, not long to go now, but can match it?
Yes. I mean, the Reform Party in our area, I don't think it's got a lot of traction. I could be wrong, but I don't think it might attract some former Tory voters, but I don't think much more than that.
But for them to go past the Conservatives is pretty extraordinary.
Well, this is the poll. I mean, okay, this is local I'm talking about. On a national basis, the Reform, well, this is the opinion polls, and I think they're rigged. They don't ask people, would you vote for the Workers' Party, for example? They can give the excuse that the Workers' Party is a national party, but on the other side, Reform doesn't even have a member of parliament, whereas at least we've got George Galloway as a member of parliament. And so the fact they're not putting George Galloway on the listings is illustrative of the manipulation that polls are used for in order to shape and nudge people to behave and to vote in a certain way. And probably Reform has been pushed forward precisely because they saw that George Galloway was doing well. Either Nigel Farage was astute enough to see that the polarization is quite significant, and that the support for the traditional mainstream parties is wavering and is insecure. And then decided to do it. Or somebody else made that decision on his behalf. Because suddenly out of the blue, long after the election had begun, Nigel Farage suddenly threw his weight into the game. So you have to ask what makes such a decision, given the fact he had decided in advance of this not to do this. So suddenly he changes his mind. Well, either he's a clever tactician who's been informed by the grassroots, he's got money, he can find things out, he can identify what the type of mood in society is, he can get opinion polls and special focus groups to inform him and report to him, And obviously something there jinxed him into standing. So perhaps it's the polarization that is going towards the Workers' Party, or potentially would go to the Workers' Party. You could also ask people who are Labour voters, would you vote for an alternative candidate, for example, Jeremy Corbyn in Islington or Feinstein in Camden and St Pancras or whatever the area is. And I think you'd find there, if you ask such a speculative question, that you'll find a very large number of Labour voters and working class voters disillusioned with the existing system would be prepared to vote for another party. And so that's why I think a reform step, or better said, Nigel Farage has stepped in and also been promoted as the alternative to the Conservative Party, because they don't want to let the Conservative ethos and philosophy disappear without reforming it into a new, reforging it into a new format that will allow conservatism, British conservatism, to reemerge like the phoenix under the under a Starmer government. I think that's the game.
Interesting. Look, finally, the context of this is that these Putney debates that are happening in Putney, where you're standing. Is that right? You're in Putney?
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that discussion was at a time of the English Civil War. I know you do these historical tours in London, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
The point of the Civil War, I think, is not taught well in British schools, which was a sort of battle between the feudal classes and the new merchant classes, you know, the capitalist emerging capitalist classes, which the capitalist classes won. And then, of course, there was Charles. It's all interesting. In the background of this, we've got, of course, King Charles III, where the Civil War was all about Charles I and Charles II. So yeah. Do you think there's any, any reflection in today's politics of what was going on in the Civil War?
Yes, the if you like, the new interests of the poor being represented through the Army Council debates and through the levellers demanding, some sections of them demanding the right to vote for all men at that time, regardless of property, brought forth all the questions that have vexed politics since the struggles for democracy began. And it, if you like, centuries ahead of its time, the debates that are still relevant were thrown up in 1647 during these few days of meetings that took place, intensively discussing the issues of the day. And people produced pamphlets and statements and arguments. And it was a very sophisticated debate, which was ahead of its time. They couldn't really escape from the property relations of their era. And there was no possibility of a real socialist society being established in a time like that. But nevertheless, in the 19th century, the conditions had changed. Urbanization developed. The majority of the population moved to the cities. And from that time onwards, the working classes have been the decisive force in politics, or at least potentially the decisive force in politics. And I think that's the case not only in Britain, but around the world today. So the Putney debates in that respect from 1647 can inform what happens today. And if you like, still reflects the same crises, but in a different way, because the working class are now so powerful that the demands that they make, if they really exercise democracy, will inevitably challenge the property relations dominating society. So the Putney debates are at putneydebates.uk. You can see the debates when they take place. And even while they're taking place, we'll stream them online as well.
Look, one question that's come out of that for me is this idea of back in the 1600s, not everyone was allowed to vote. We've now got over a million people who do not have voter ID. So even if they do decide to go and vote, which they probably won't, but if they do, they'll be turned away.
Yeah, I mean, the political process is farcical. And one of the aspects of campaigning this election is to reveal how farcical it is, so, and to reveal the limitations of it. And so that's why I won the Putney debates. Two, inside the debates, I point out to people, because a lot of people say, what are you going to do about this? What are you going to do about this in this community or that community? I pointed out to people, the MP does not decide these things. All the MP can do is put their face to a campaign and support it. Or, for example, there's a case in Wimbledon Park where Wimbledon Lawn Tennis want to take over a big park and make some huge complex there. And the people there are protesting. Well, what can an MP actually do? An MP can, okay, sit in front of the bulldozer as a symbolic act. But otherwise, the MP is quite limited in what they're able to do. So you need to understand about how to increase the power of the people from below. And that's the reason why I'm standing in this election. And if I was to win the election, I would continue with that frame of thinking in Parliament itself and expose the limits of Parliament and the need for popular power from below.
Well, I hope you'll have time to continue your Marxist tours as well. Hi, Koku. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.